What's up, buddies? Welcome to Agitated Podcast, episode
4.
4. What is time? Thanks for being here. Thanks for still being here. We're getting better at this, and we really appreciate you still fucking listening.
We hope. That's optimistic.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's people besides our moms who have listened. I've seen that. Okay, so we're gonna talk about, as we do, what is agitating us right now. Caitlin.
So,
let's have it.
Okay, I wanted to talk about how New York State has the votes, has the policy to pass Medicare for All, to become the first state to do it, and they're not going to. Even though their bill, called the New York Health Act, has passed their state assembly 5 times already over the years. This year, the legislative session is about to end and the bill is stuck in committee. It's not even gotten a vote and it's not going to happen. And I just want to, like, okay, so first of all, I was talking to someone the other day and just kind of thinking about, like, what is the most, in my opinion, the most strategic thing that progressives and the left and anyone who cares about other people should be doing is trying to get Medicare for All implemented. Because, I mean, it will just have an enormous impact on people's lives, but also from a strategic perspective, it's kind of like the only legislation that we have that is like the systemic solution in and of itself. You know, like the Green New Deal, it's pretty vague what it actually is and how that would actually get implemented, or some of the other policies. But this is like the systemic answer. It is not a reformist reform. It is the solution for how healthcare should be. And we're close in that we have the majority of Americans that want it. We have desperate need for it. We have been able to show that it actually would be more cost effective. We have had the pandemic, which illustrates how important and critical it is and how much better off we would have been as a country if we had had universal health care, right? And so, like, everyone who has the means to help make this happen should be weighing in. Why isn't it happening? It isn't. It's getting killed in New York in large part because of labor unions and the Democratic Party. Working on behalf of labor unions. And it's just like, it's no good reason. So just like to catch people up. So there's no question that lobbying by health insurance companies is on big, and business groups as well. So there has been, you know, a ton of advertising targeting seniors, opposing the legislation. So, you know, their propaganda wing is like,
so much money.
Yeah, in full force. But it doesn't matter. They still have the votes. The majority of people in both houses of the legislature in New York have co-sponsored the bill. So all they would have to do is just put it to the floor and it would pass. But the reason why it isn't is because labor unions are, not all labor unions, but specifically this kind of federation in the state, the New York Municipal Labor Committee, has, you know, objected strenuously to the New York Healthcare Act in 2021, which represents 102 municipal unions, so basically like public employee unions. And supposedly they support universal healthcare, but they want to see a carve out for union workers. And then the United Federation of Teachers, which, like, this is also so sad because, like, the teachers are held, you know, in the last few years have been talked about as, like, one of the most important strategic unions. They have done successful striking. They have flexed power in a way that has been incredibly inspiring and mobilizing. Yeah, for labor on the whole, you know, through what teachers have done in key cities like Chicago and L.A., really awesome work. But U of T is also opposed to this bill in New York. And again, they're not opposed to universal health care, but their argument is that unions have sacrificed wage increases in the past few, you know, years in order to bargain for better health care coverage and lower costs, and forcing unions union employees to switch to a single payer system would make that past work a waste. So the argument.
I'm sorry, what?
Yes, this is U of T's
Wait
argument.
A second.
And MLC.
Are you fucking kidding me?
No.
That's absurd.
This is totally along the lines, though, of like the student debt relief. Like, oh, I didn't get it. Like, nobody else can. You know what I mean? Like, why are we jealous of the future generations having better?
Right.
You should be like, yes, we helped lay the groundwork for this. Right. Like, this is what we've been working towards for everyone to have their needs met.
Right.
What the absolute fuck?
No, it's horrible. It's horrible. And it's so short-sighted. Yes. And also knowing there's no way that these unions don't understand how huge it would be for everyone in the country, for any state, to move single payer forward. I mean, it would be enormous. So, but their argument is, oh, this should happen at the federal level. And, you know, we've basically been having to, like, they're making the case for why we should have single payer because, you know, unions when they're collectively bargaining for what they will get from employers, they're told they have to pick between healthcare benefits or wages. And healthcare benefits matter so much to so many people that people are willing to forego wage increases if their employer will give them better healthcare benefits. So it's like they get that. They understand that. And then they're just like, fuck everybody else who isn't in a position to be able to have a union to leverage. We did it last year. So next year. Well, even though it's like, okay, but what would you be able to bargain for next time when you have your universal coverage? Because everybody has universal coverage, medical coverage. And so then you could start to demand higher wages.
I can't even, that is so absurdly stupid. Like, I can't even, that makes me boil.
Yeah, it's just, like, it's so.
Also, what is this strategy with, like, yes, it does need to happen on a federal level, but it's not. Like, you have one of the most progressive Congresses, like, with Democrats in control of all these things. We've talked about this a million times. There's no political will. They're unwilling to use their power to do that on a federal level. It's not happening. And so, like, it makes a lot of sense that New York would start that, and that is a thing. Like, that.
Right, exactly.
I don't.
And that's why it's. That's why they've, you know, had this assembly bill over and over and over again. So, just like what happened in California, where it's like, finally, when we had a governor in California, where the governor, you know, when Newsom took over for Schwarzenegger and the governor could no longer be blamed for being the one that's going to veto Medicare for All. And then all of a sudden our state legislature, even though we have supermajority, isn't willing to pass it either. And it dies in committee at the hand of the Democrats, even though, and also it would be, I mean, it would be so huge for strategically for the fight for healthcare for all for any state to do it. And then also this really just not only would it be strategic to move forward, but moving backwards like this also sets, you know, just the tone for like who we're going to bow down, what the argument is to use against us. Oh, well, some workers have, you know, a little bit of benefits, and so they don't really care. And it's not even, remember what happened in 2020 in the presidential campaign in the primary in Nevada, when the largest labor union in Nevada came out against Bernie Sanders for the same reason of, we don't want Medicare for all because we've been bargaining for healthcare and you're going to fuck up our bargaining. And Sanders was able to still win that caucus, though, because rank and file members of that same union. So the union bosses who are coming out against Medicare for all, it's like, I don't know what the story is in New York, but odds are that not all of those workers are not on board with this throwing of other workers under the bus for their bargaining.
Absolutely.
As we saw in Nevada.
Absolutely.
So
it's just so it's like this classic tactic too of being like, if you have a little bit more than other people because you've worked really hard for it, and if other people have it, it's going to diminish what you have. And so, like, you know,
which is the theme on this show.
You should
divide and conquer.
Yep.
Works really fucking well against us. And it kills me that unions organizations supposedly on the left with tons of resources are falling into that. I mean, so often it's like, it's kind of understandable why when we're so scrappy, we don't have the capacity to like be proactive or strategic sometimes even, or coordinated, because it's like, well, that's easier said than done. But like what it would actually take to do, I mean, there's a reason why the right is able to coordinate. They have the resources to do that, right? But it's like, even when the people on our side who do have commensurate resources, they're not even willing to be strategic about, you know, what is the battle? We want healthcare for all workers. How do we get there? We're a key leverage point. Let's leverage it. But instead it's like, nope, let's pull out and fuck everyone and claim that we're doing it for the sake of workers. And somehow or other, you know, and I will say too, like I was reading this Jacobin article about it, and it's quoting one of the organizers who's, you know, one of the lead folks who's been working for this bill. And, you know, she even has to be very careful in naming what's happening, you know, because you don't want to piss off labor. And she, you know, she talks about it like we need to win them over. And it's like, they should already be on our side. We should not have to grovel with them to move an agenda forward that would help all workers. It just, anyway,
I absolutely keep saying the same thing
over and over again here. So sorry, happy Friday, but like, yeah, this is really agitating, and it is, as I was reading it, this article and kind of putting the pieces together, it just made me think about how the argument for one union for all workers makes a hell of a lot of sense, because otherwise you have, you know, these turf wars and power trips and losing sight of what the goal is, which is to build solidarity and power for people who have to work to earn a living. And it shouldn't matter whether they're nurses or teachers or whatever.
Yes, of course. One union makes a lot of sense. And also, fundamentally, Medicare for all makes sense.
Oh, totally.
Bottom line. Which is why they say that they're all supporting. We are the only industrialized country that doesn't have it. It's not that it's a trick to do successfully. Mm-hmm. So
Jesus Christ.
And it's happening all over too. The California example, the Nevada example, the New York example, and then also apparently in Colorado just recently, SEIU was working for, or no, there was, they were working on a public option legislation, so not even single payer. And SEIU helped water down the bill. And they ended up passing a bill that creates a public option in 2 years if private insurers don't reduce premiums by 15%, but healthcare providers will not be required to accept the insurance. So it's like, thanks for fucking nothing there, too. Which is interesting, you know, because it's like SEIU is one of the unions that's working for the Medicare for All bill in New York, but against this one in Colorado. And it just goes to show, it's like, this is a systemic problem. This is not about like leadership or particulars. This is about the fact that unions have lost sight of the forest for the trees or whatever
the
it is.
The point. Yeah, the exactly. Fucking point.
Well, you know what? It is sort of interesting because we so rely on, or we think of, you know, as healthcare being provided under an employment in this country. Like, this is the way that you do it. And we were, you know, we were so like, oh, the small businesses can't afford $15 an hour. But when you put the onus of providing healthcare for your employees on a small business, the toll on that is so much greater.
Which
everybody
is
could be being paid $50 an hour.
Right,
you know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly.
If we had some sort of universal healthcare system.
Right. And this is why there's no person who even works, let alone runs a labor union, who doesn't understand the algebra of that reality, of that situation. Which is why, again, I come back to, there is no policy more important for us to move forward than Medicare for All. And everybody who has resources should be helping to do that. Certainly not undermining it.
I completely agree. This is when they cash in. This is when, like you were saying, when we were talking to Daniel too, right? This is the point in which you're there you go. Use it. This is the thing. Cash it in. Fucking do it. No.
Right. Mm-mm. What are we organizing for if when we have the actual votes, we fucking walk away and don't make the policy happen? Then what is the point of all the fundraising that everybody has been doing and the, you know, changing of people's minds? I mean, it's incredible that we have been able to help the majority of Americans, no matter which political party they're in, understand that universal health care would be better for them with the propaganda that we have in this country from insurance corporations. And yeah, and yeah, still
it's all just feel good blah blah point. Yep. Yeah, and it's related to a million other issues. I know that you know this, but like, you know, there are like, one example is just like, if you separate healthcare from employment and everyone has equal access to healthcare, then you don't have to have people marrying for, this is like a thing we'll talk about later because we're going to do an episode on it, but like, you don't have to have people forced into marriages and staying in situations and vulnerable in situations where they don't have power because their spouse or whatever has healthcare. Like, that is, I know it, maybe I don't know if I'll cut this out. It sounds like a little out there, but I'm just like, it's like the equal access to healthcare prevents abuse. And like, I've just been thinking a lot about that lately. And also, like, you know, people who are undocumented, who, you know, you, when you have to rely on someone for being healthy because they have a job that has benefits, that's inherently like, and that's bad.
Totally. It creates, it creates dependence in all kinds of ways. It creates dependence on workers that have to stay in abusive jobs. Right. You know, it makes it so that we cannot be independent and get out of situations where we have a financial, you know, where we're financially stuck because we can't afford to, because that's the only way to get medical care.
And without it, if you go there of like, you know, how sick of a, you know, roller coaster you're put on if you don't have health care and you do have any medical experience or, you know, medical crisis or medical needs, which then you get medical bills for, which, you know, this is like 40% or something of all the bankruptcies in the U.S. are over medical bills. So, like, you know, you're inundated with debt, you lose housing, and then what happens? I mean, mental health isn't intertwined with that. You know, then your employment is. I mean, it's so related to literally every facet of our lives, whether we can take care of ourselves when we're sick, or our family, or children inheriting the medical debt of, you know, their parents.
Well, and also, you know, tons of people who are technically insured are undercovered, and so they don't actually go to the doctor. So having health insurance is really, for tons of people, only something that is a relief when there is, you know, some huge accident. But what if you have a chronic illness where you're sick at a low level all the time in a way that needs, you know, ongoing treatment? And your deductible is so high that you're not going to go because you can't afford it. And that's the reality for tons of people. I mean, yeah, our system is so broken and so wrong. And again, you know, just to take it back and then we can move to whoever wants to go next. But, you know, the people who understand this the best are people who work for labor unions because they make all of these arguments when they're bargaining for their workers. Yeah. And so they get it. They totally get it. And there's just no excuse why they wouldn't support this bill in New York or any other state that moves it forward. And we're not going to be able to get Medicare for all if they don't shift on this. It's going to be impossible. And it's a convenient excuse that Democrats can use because they rely on labor unions to stay in office. And that's the leverage that unions have. And it's so icky that that's how you would use your power.
So IWW.org.
Well, okay, moving on to, you know, let's, people in the room pretending that we don't have enough money for healthcare when we know there is an exorbitant amount of money in policing. And so I want to talk a little bit more about policing and actually the partnerships that are happening across the country between police departments and the Israeli Defense Army, because we are sending our police officers to Israel to be trained by their military. And this is, you know, this is happening all across the country, again, from Florida, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, California, Arizona, Connecticut, New York, Massachusetts, North Carolina, Georgia, Washington State, D.C. It's everywhere. It's so prevalent.
Just real quick, I want to understand this better. So they, like, ship individual officers, or they have, like, a training program. Israel's like, hi, we have a training program for U.S. police. Like, who do they...
The nuts and bolts works in, like, various ways. I think there is a lot of in-person where we do actually send them over to Israel, but I think that there's also, you know, back and forth with that, or mm-hmm. however they do it. Like, you know, varies by state or whatever. But a really gross piece for me, because, of course... You know, we know last month all of the violence that has happened and has been happening, you know, for decades in Palestine, you know, by Israel. And this is now, we are now, the ceasefire has been broken. Violence is erupting again. And just the tactics that we're seeing used by the Israeli army are tactics that our police use. I mean, from things like kneeling on someone's back that was used to kill George Floyd is something that is commonly used, you know, by the Israeli Defense Army. So these are, you know, we're seeing this reflected.
Well, and also Palestinians have, like, no rights. And so the way the Israel Defense Army works is, you know, they can kill whoever. There's no, you know, there's no oversight, really. And that's exactly what I'm saying. It's like, if you train people and it's like, okay, this is how you deal with people that you're dealing with. And in this country, in theory, you know, people do have rights and protections and et cetera. And that's kind of the, you know, the constant. When you're in that mode of like, this is what you do. This is how you grab somebody to arrest them. And you're thinking, you know, this is a citizen who I need to pay attention to, and I might have, you know, there might be ramifications for what I do, versus this doesn't matter at all, I'm in a war zone. You're just going to be trained in very different tactics. You're going to learn very different tactics about how you operate, and then you bring it back here.
Yeah, like the orientation towards the people you are policing,
right,
is inherently, like, violent.
So right. I want to bring another piece into this, which is this partnership, you know, and which is growing, has been coddled and fostered by the Anti-Defamation League, which was an organization, you know, that rose out of, you know, the devastating effects of the Holocaust to combat not only anti-Semitism, but, you know, all sorts of oppressions, except when it comes to Israel, right? So yeah. They have, with this, like, cover, you know, wonderful face of Anti-Defamation League. Like, how good does that sound, right? Actually.
And they've done good work, you know?
Right. Not to say that they haven't either, but that this undertone of, you know, unless you're Palestinian, which, you know, we've heard the chants in Israel over the last week, death to Arabs. Like, there we are. I mean, there it is.
That's disturbing. And it also speaks to, like, again, the relationship between the struggles of the movement for Black Lives here and the movement for Palestinian liberation. There's so many similarities, and this is just another. It's just...
Well, and coming back to, like, what we need to address to make people safe in this country is abolishing the police, because there's nothing coming out of that institution that is helping us. And we're seeing that because the communities that are the most policed and have the most money going into their police departments are not the safest. The ones right. with the healthcare, the school, the education, the, you know what I mean?
Right.
And another reminder, absolutely. You know, to constantly keep your eye on the military industrial complex, which is trickling into every facet of our lives.
Yeah, not trickling, yeah. Like squirming its way, wrestling, like nasty tendrils.
Of... Waterboarding your face. Is that better? Yeah.
God, I feel so tired of the world today.
Yeah, I do right worry now. About our show and this, because it's like, you know, the goal is not to make people feel overwhelmed and depressed. But you can't change anything if you're not real about what you're dealing with. And that's that's where we're coming from, but it can be kind of overwhelming too.
Yeah, and there's so much inspiration porn that it's like, you got to be able to handle a range of emotions, you know? This is not a good vibes only podcast, although I'd say we have good vibes.
Well, truth is, you know, I mean, that's what we're trying to dig out, right? And so that's, it's important for liberation. It just isn't necessarily fuzzy all the time.
Right. Everyone after this, go and, like, you know, eat something yummy and salty, masturbate, and watch Netflix. Like, we have to balance our lives. We all know that. Like,
I will.
We're not saying, like, take all the joy out of it just because we're calling out the realities that have to change.
Oh, pleasure and joy and rest are as revolutionary as anything.
And that's why we want to, right? You know, we should be able to be spending our lives exploring that, and instead of dredging for capitalism, right?
Yeah, that's the life, right?
We're fucking mammals. We should act like it.
Oh, come mammals on, you only have to dredge till for capitalism till you're 65. And then it's okay. Unless right, you did shitty at capitalism. And then you have to bag at Walmart until you die.
Yeah, exactly. That 65, you get to retire reality is just like millennials don't have the reality of being able to buy a house and slog away and then at least be able to die in that house. Like, at this point, even older people don't get... It's all a sham! Don't believe the dream. Anyway, we're on a tangent. Jessica was agitating.
Okay, well,
you.
I do listen. That's why I bring this up, because I actually, there's something pretty fucking dope that happened recently that I want to talk about. My microphone just became broken loose. Okay. So you may have heard. The Canadian company TC Energy says it's canceling construction of the Keystone motherfucking XL pipeline.
That's awesome.
That Woo-hoo! Is fucking sweet. Yes, take a moment, because listen, Medicare for All, I agree. That is like what we got to be doing. That's some of the most impactful work. And also stopping pipelines is like some, it's that shit is like so important and direct and beautiful. And so I just wanted to talk about it because there was a real success recently. So we all know about the Keystone XL pipeline because there was a big moment during the Standing Rock protest where lots and lots and lots of people went to Standing Rock to help occupy the land to resist the XL pipeline that was being built there. So it had like a big moment, and there was a moment of learning and I think seeing these water protectors and land protectors for the first time for a lot of people. So there's a bunch of Indigenous people, especially elders, who have been consistently occupying that land since before the Standing Rock moment and since
way before.
To just wait. You know, this is like a generational fight, right? This didn't happen in 2017 or whatever that was, but the consistency of these land and water protectors is what made this work. And so the cancellation is a result of that resistance. Don't get it twisted. And because of that, there was a moment where they were able to pressure Biden to cancel the permit. You know, early in his presidency, and it was one of the first things he did. And
oh, so I'm people actually carried on the fight once people who maybe would implement the change got in power? Wow.
Exactly that, right? Like, people weren't like, oh, Biden won. Yeah, that's probably going to be fine.
He'll take care of this.
Okay, bitch, here it is.
Yeah.
Now. And so that is like, that is badass. And I think, so one thing that should be talked about is like, not only the consistency, but the variety of tactics that were used, you know, by these folks to resist this. So occupation was a huge one, and lots of nonviolent civil disobedience. Lots of people have been arrested in this fight, right?
And are still fighting, were chaining them to not be in jail forever.
Exactly.
I mean, big sacrifices.
Huge. Yeah. There are people right now facing, you know, decades in prison because of their resistance to this. They've been chaining themselves to the equipment, you know, occupying the ground, just the most beautiful shit ever. So, of course, though, what always happens is that when a corporation or some giant devastating thing is resisted and stops, it inevitably tries to go somewhere else. And so, you know, I think whenever we talk about these wins, we have to understand that that didn't go away, and that doesn't detract from the fucking amazingness of what happened, but that it's a vigilant, constant struggle, right? And nobody knows that better than these Indigenous elders. So there is what's called Enbridge Line 3 right now, that is the current object of resistance, which is happening in Minnesota, so-called Minnesota, and Anishinaabe people, I hope that I said that right, are the main folks whose land it is intruding on. And, you know, these pipelines are not only horrific and bad and devastating, but they're also violations of, like, human rights and cultural rights and treaties. So there was an 1855 treaty that this new Pipeline 3 is in violation of, and they're calling on Biden to stop this one too. So, you know, the fight is not over, but I think it's worth taking a moment to be agitated by things that actually work and people who actually are understanding of what it takes to protect the planet, and that we should be looking to them for leadership and guidance and following their lead, because they got that done, and that's amazing. And anything you read that says, you know,
thank you, Biden
did this is bullshit. Biden did, but not even worth saying his name, right? Like, the people who did this were the Indigenous elders and young people. I don't mean to say it was just elders, but fuck, it was cool. So that's what I'm feeling agitated about, in a really, really good way.
Nice.
Yay, that's that.
Yeah.
We should include a link to the action in Minnesota, because they are actively asking people to come.
Yeah, for sure. We'll do that. So check the episode notes for more information about how you can get involved.
This is our transition to the next thing.
That's perfect. The next thing, it's coming up.
I'm not doing that. Okay.
So this is an episode where we don't have a guest with us. So we wanted to just spend some time talking about our own, I don't know, what's the word? It's not, is it evolution or development or path or journey?
Trajectory.
I mean, I think we're naming that it's like about radicalization. We right. objectively think that yeah. it is good to be radicalized, because, and by that we mean getting to the roots of problems and an analysis that understands the roots of problems. So, and we want to look at what radicalized us. And that's still an ongoing process.
Right. And I was noticing something in our interviews that we've done so far. When we ask this question to other people, so far, people are just talking about experiences they've had. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily some big, giant event, but more just like, I met this person and they changed my perspective on this. Or like, I picked up some trash and then I realized that was related to this thing. It's so personal. And, you know, so while this feels a little bit self-indulgent and we're sort of like, ah, do you really want to hear about all of the things? I think a big reason why we're doing this podcast is to be like, you know, we all have to get where we are and where we're going in terms of seeing the world for how it is. So yeah, thanks for listening to us work through some of that.
And I think, you know, this will be good because even though we're all four very close and have been for a long time and share a very similar analysis, I think we all arrived here in very different ways. And so I think, you know, I like seeing myself in other people. That's something that I feel good when I like see, you know, so the hope, I think, is that we all kind of talk about how we got to this point and, you know, you might see yourself in some of it and feel like maybe, you know, you're on the right track.
And we have a critique of a leftist tendency, which is that everybody should be fully evolved, no mistakes, you know, what's wrong with you if you don't understand XYZ, and a lot of shame and, humiliation directed at people mm-hmm. who are not, like, who don't get whatever. And the reality is that all of us at some point think something now that we, if we're honest, probably are, like, at least a little bit chagrined that we thought what we thought before. And so trying to,
oh yeah,
yeah, trying to take response, you know, just trying to say, like, we can't build an inclusive movement if there's not room for people to be able to evolve. And in fact, none of us are evolved to the point where we need to be, right? So trying to really make clear that as radicals, we want to be humble about it, and we want to push that to be the way that we help people radicalize, we the left, instead of how it has been, which is like either you're woke or you're an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
So like some of the things that we want to explore was like, what are some of the national or international political events that have shaped our political analysis, and like, how did that happen? Some values that we might have learned growing up from our family or others, or experiences that shaped our political perspective, how our political analysis has evolved over time, and what helped contribute to that evolution. And then also, I learned from a group that used to be called Smart Meme. Now they're called the Center for Story-Based Strategy, about this concept of like a psychic break, which is when something that you thought was true is no longer feels true because of like an event or an experience that happens. And it's very unsettling, and it can be very confusing in the moment. But oftentimes that is an opportunity for radicalization, or opening your eyes and seeing something that you didn't see before. So just wanted to also, you know, talk about any of those experiences that we might have had, and kind of how that goes. Because as we're in a society that is breaking down in a number of ways, that provides both the opportunity and the threat of, you know, psychic breaks. And sometimes those can be, you know, good in the long run experiences that like help you see better, but also they can be, you know, traumatic and or confusing in a way that causes you to like go backwards and hold on to things in a way that like doesn't actually even make sense. And that discord within you is like disturbing and can cause, you know, fucked up shit. So just wanting to kind of give us that framework so that in case people we know experience some kind of psychic break, or, you know, culturally we all are going through something, that there can be people among us who kind of have words for describing what that is and how to get through it in a way that is evolutionary instead of reverting. Well, let's just, I mean, just dive in. Why don't you start, Jessica? I think you're good at starting, and I also just said a lot of things.
I really was trying to think, like, what's the first thing I really remember happening that was a big deal that gave me perspective on something that I didn't know yet? And I think that was when I was 7 years old, Matthew Shepard was killed. And I think that was the first time I ever heard of gay people. And I think that was the first time I ever heard of torture also, because I remember it really distinctly. And then growing up, we went to a really groovy Episcopal church. My best friend's dad was the preacher. And when I was in sixth or seventh grade, the church, like the larger Episcopal church, was voting on whether or not to ordain the first gay bishop. They were voting like on a national level. So everybody who was a rector was voting. And my friend's dad voted in favor of him, of ordaining him, and proudly so. And the community just became very divided. And some people in my family even had some very yikes things to say. And there were some strong pro-gay messages and also some strong anti-gay messages coming from people that I loved and trusted. And it was really impactful and confusing. And there was just a lot of friction around that. And then I also remember I was really obsessed with rock and roll as a kid, and like would just dive in so deep to like, I would just read books about the Beatles and Led Zeppelin. I was just like, I used to get really obsessive about musicians. And I remember when I first learned that my favorite musicians did drugs, and I was just like, like, what an innocent kid, right? I was just like, it broke me. Did you guys know Jimmy Page did drugs? Yeah.
Shut up.
So, I know. So it was just like, oh shit.
I was going to say, I think he did some worse things than that, but.
Don't break her more!
No, that came later. That was some years later. But, you know, shit, I was just like, oh my God, people do drugs, you know? Okay, and then 9/11 happened, right? And that changed the entire world. I was still a kid when that happened. We got the internet and the Patriot Act all in that same period. And there was just a whole lot of like nationalistic propaganda thrown at me that I really had to unlearn because I was in a small rural town. It was just everywhere. There was no alternative to the like, defend America, we will kick your ass. And like, you remember that Bush era patriotism? It was a specific flavor.
Yeah.
And then war on TV all the time. And my parents always had the TV on, always, like always. And there was always news on, just so much fucking war. And then Columbine, which was the start of an era, I think, in a lot of ways. Oh,
that's so interesting because that one, I mean, I remember it. I was older, you know, I was like not in school anymore. Right. So it didn't feel relevant in the way that it must have for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think about like my little sister is 10 years younger than me. And she had active shooter drills. All through school. You know what I mean? That wasn't a thing when I was in school yet because Columbine was sort of like, whoa, this can happen, you know. And then we had bomb drills and fire drills and all those things, but we didn't have that yet. You know, so that was just really fucking scary.
Can you go and back? Then, can I interrupt you for 1 second? I want to, this maybe is just like selfishly, but okay. So you grew up in Paradise, Northern California, and what you were talking about in terms of like it being mind boggling that people did drugs. In my mind, having lived in Humboldt County, but as more of an adult, my sense is like everyone in California at least knew about like that cannabis was like prevalent in everybody's lives, even if it wasn't behind the scenes way. Weed. Okay, okay. So,
sorry. Yeah, yeah. What I mean is like drugs.
Okay, okay.
But clarifying on this show, we don't refer to cannabis as a drug.
She was talking as a little medicinal kid.
Substance.
No, I actually do want to say something here because growing up in Florida, and Caitlin, you didn't grow up in California either.
I didn't grow up in California.
Where I do think that people who grow up here, you kind of grow up separating those two things, whereas I grew up being told that they were all bad and they were all categorized together. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I hadn't.
Oh. I figured that out for myself at 16.
Well, you're more evolved then, I guess, Millie. Or perhaps, again, like, my parents kept it on the DL. Anyway, when you said that, I was trying to understand because I do. Yes, thank you, Shelley, because it is, if you didn't live in Northern California or maybe California, but I think Northern California, you have a certain, like, you don't understand how the rest of the country.
Well, it's kind of like how they have California sober, whereas everywhere else, if you're sober and you're in kind of even in like 12-step recovery, like you have to quit everything that's part of the culture of recovery. But in California, in many places, it's California sober where you can still smoke weed.
Really?
It's like totally different rules.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Right.
Thanks for clarifying. That's really interesting. I do remember learning that people smoked weed, but I was way younger than that. And that wasn't like drugs to me. That was just like, it was like cigarettes or alcohol. Like that adults do that, but it wasn't like drugs. So,
It's been brought to our attention how Californian we sound and our California bias on this podcast. Even though we don't all currently live in California, we all have at some point. So I think we should have a little bit of like cognizance about that.
Yeah.
Right. And some acknowledgement to, you know, the drugness of it being that people are still incarcerated in huge ways due to it. So let's not like diminish that by our California lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So then there was the recession, kind of, you know, as I was like becoming an adult. That started a little later, I guess, than I'm thinking now. And then there was Prop 8, which was the ban on gay marriage in California. And that happened when I was in high school. And I grew up in a heavily Mormon town with many, many, many of my classmates and teachers and friends' parents and neighbors who really supported it and were very vocal about it. So that was just difficult knowing what everyone thought about that. One moment that really shifted my thinking was around 16 or 17. Probably 16. I took a trip with a youth group, actually. It was a really liberal, like groovy one. And we went to spend a few days in San Francisco meeting people and learning stuff and like sorting clothes for a, you know, clothes bank or something. And It was then that I met someone who was really open with me about living with HIV. And it was just like early enough that I didn't quite yet have a stigma about it or know much about it. So it was really my first lesson about HIV, really, and was, I think, both a lesson that lots of people live with HIV and that's not something to have any sort of stigma about, and also that a lot of queer people died from HIV/AIDS and that that is to be known and respected and have the weight that it deserves. So then I moved away from home for college to Humboldt County. I studied political science with an emphasis in globalization. So that is, you know, like a I learned a lot during that, of course. And then I spent a bit of time living in Bangalore, India for part of college. And when I was 20, on a program taking classes at a Jesuit college, oddly enough. And that time was just really, really formative for me. And like, you know, I don't mean to sound like I really don't want to like exoticize this experience or like anything, but you know, I was at a formative moment.
I wanted to say something about the traveling because that one's really hard. I struggle with that one a lot because, you know, I lived in a different country for some years as a kid. It just makes a really big difference to be exposed to different cultures. And I think it's really helpful. But then the fucking fossil fuel footprint of that plus other problems.
Well, it's like also a class thing. I never got to go anywhere because I never had the money to. It just wasn't like an option.
Anyway, I don't know if there's a right answer. I think it's worse now than it was though, given what we know about the environmental impact. But
yeah, and I just didn't quite have all that analysis when I went. Like, you know, I'm not saying that living abroad is necessarily like a bad thing to do, but I'm just acknowledging there's class stuff there and there's lots of other things there, right? I'm not trying to be naive to that. So as I say these things, but it was still really formative. So during that time, I just learned a lot. We lived there and we did service, you know, and there it wasn't like a charity situation at all, but it was volunteer. It was white people volunteering. So that is what it is, right? But we were volunteering at a home for children with HIV, and that was really impactful for me. And we spent a lot of time at a home for girls who had survived trafficking, like really young girls under 12. And these experiences were just really impactful to me to be like it was overwhelming. It's such a big thing that it was overwhelming. And so for me, that kind of led to like, what's the why though? Because there's so much and there has to be something that is sort of, these are related. I don't know. I started thinking, the overwhelm started to lead to strategic thinking, I think, in some way. So I started to think differently. And then also, I think a lot of lessons during this time about trust. And the first time I ever lived in any city, you know what I mean? I went from rural to rural, and then I was like in a giant city. And so, you know, it wasn't India. It was just like traveling and being in a city and growing up. You know?
Although we lived in Barcelona when I was 9, and I would say that was like the safest. I mean, my mom got, you know, her purse stolen and things like that, which don't happen here much in Sacramento, in my experience. But in terms of like being able to be a kid, walk to school, you know, play alone. I mean, I know that people don't do that anymore in this country, and I don't know if they do in Europe, but it was interesting to be in such a huge city and feel like people left and right would like be looking out for you, and you just didn't need to worry that people didn't have your back or wouldn't pay attention if something sketchy started to happen.
It's a very collectivist culture, and so you just see people living really differently. It's just different cause you to think differently. And I'll tell you, never once was I afraid of gun violence in India. Like, we would talk about that all the time. Like, I got sexually assaulted a lot. And that, again, is just a matter of being in a densely populated area. There's so many people. But I never thought someone was going to pull out a gun in a crowded space. That just isn't a thing. You know, I mean, I'm sure there are anomalies, but that was also the time when I met my now wife. And until then, I hadn't really totally admitted to myself that I was bisexual. So that was suddenly a new lens, and just everything felt really new. That was a huge psychic break. It was like, oh my God, the world is this different thing. There are a lot of wow moments there. And also, I went to India with the hopes of seeing sort of Indian like people's movements up close. You know, there's a really rich history of civil disobedience and direct action and powerful like showing up. And I wanted to study that kind of, and it was I was a little bit more like academic at the time, I think, than like sort of organizery. So it was sort of like a little bit intellectual. And it was a period during which they were deciding on caste representation in elected positions. And it was a huge movement there, moment in the movement there. And it was just really impactful. And also that was during Occupy. And so seeing that from afar at first was an interesting perspective, because the media really made it seem like these were rich white kids who didn't really have any real demands, you know? And so then getting home, I was like, oh, this isn't that. These are real concerns about a really corrupt system. And living for a bit in an Indian system, which is also very corrupt, but in a different way. Like, you bribe everyone. You bribe everyone, cops, bureaucrats, everyone. And people, you know, are like, yeah, India's so much more corrupt. And I'm like, that's not true. It's just loud. And so sort of seeing a different
way. Well, and
way
when there's
that
a
looks...
baseline of corruption that pretty much like everybody can participate in, like in this country, we can't participate in the corruption that the rich are pulling off. Right. We can't not pay our taxes. We can't bribe elected officials or have paid lobbyists, you know? So it's like the stratification. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that there is that in India too for wealthy people, but still it's like, there's, you know, there's like no corruption on one level, kind of. And then there's like a huge jump to like enormous corruption. And it's just so stark. And only a tiny percentage of the people in this country participate in it at all.
That's true. Like, Indian bribery is democratic. Everyone can participate, you know.
I mean, you have to have money, but
we can't even get democratic corruption.
Yeah, what can I get for $5? Nothing. Nothing in this country.
Yeah. Oh, $5, you could get out of like a speeding ticket and a half.
Right,
probably,
exactly.
You know what I mean?
So, nobody right, can get so, out of a speeding ticket with a bribe. You have to actually know the mayor and have a fucking lunch, and then you can get out, not in the moment.
So seeing that accessible corruption was really just something. I had a really, really fucking scary experience at a police station where I witnessed police brutality like right in front of my body, like in a very extreme way. And it really shook me and scared the fuck out of me. And, you know, my body wasn't in danger. So I don't mean to sound like that. But I saw it in a way that was just, I've never seen anything like that. And so that was very scary. And then there was also a class I took on social stratification while I was there. And that was the first educator who ever gave me, or person ever who gave me, a non-Zionist perspective on Palestine. And, you know, I had studied political science, like, you know, I was political, but no one ever, ever talked about it like he did. And it really shook me. And I had to work out a lot of things and feelings and unlearn some really deep propaganda. And my professor really held space for me to do that, as did, you know, my now wife. And that just like took me longer than I'd like to admit. But that was a first.
But that's a good thing to admit, especially within the current conversation where everybody's like acting like if you have, you know, some Zionist ideals that it's all on you. But really, this is absolutely what people are taught. And to go into your adult years, have never, ever, ever having seen another viewpoint on that is hideous.
Yeah. Or meeting Palestinians or many Muslim people. I don't know that I had any relationships or anyone who had family in Palestine, like anything before this. And so like I would meet people, friends, and they'd be like, hey, can you stop helping Israel kill my family? And I was like, what? Like, I've never heard anything like that before. So wow. And then just something that I wanted to say, I think, because it's important to talk about and destigmatize mental health, is that like I have an anxiety disorder and a panic disorder, and I have depression, and it massively impacts me. Like, it's like a, I heard someone else on a podcast refer to it as a, like a backpack. And I was like, yeah, it's like a backpack I wear every day, you know, particularly the anxiety and panic part. And one day, one night when I was in my early 20s, I felt like I had a break. I had like a severe panic attack that I felt like I just broke entirely in half. And it was a real wake up call to like get some help. And also me coming through that night and pulling myself out of that was like hard work. And I just... And then after college, I was having a hard time finding work and got involved at an LGBTQ resource center and was helping to think about pride planning. And there was just a lot of companies that wanted to get in on pride that I just had a moment of disgust. And like, these companies donate to anti-gay politicians all year, and then they wave this rainbow flag and we're supposed to love them and invite them in. And like, at that point, I just started to think about corporations and their impact on culture. And then someone at the resource center told me that there was a job opening at an organization called Move to Amend. And I'm like, fuck yeah, that sounds really good. And there was a really steep learning curve for me when I started. It was like putting on glasses, kind of, you know, like you're just like, oh, like everything's just sort of a little bit more clear. And there was a period of learning for me for sure. But that was a moment. And then, you know, and then just like Obama, like I worked on, I worked on like Obama's campaign. And, you know, I worked on Obama's campaign. I was like, and then he just lied about everything. He lied about everything. And I'm just like, yo, I'm not stupid. I know when someone's just talking a good game. Like, once I learned that Obama was full of shit, it just broke politics open for me. And I started to understand, like, most people are just looking for someone who speaks nicely and makes you feel, like,
smart.
Good. Yeah.
And not racist. Like, makes you feel like you're not racist.
No. Yeah, you need to feel not racist, and you need to feel like you would like to have a beer with them. And I know that's a cliche, no, but so that's true. So fucking true. I was just like, oh man, all this is so bullshit. You know, it feels good to believe in something. But then when you learn there's something else to believe in, that's cool mm-hmm. too. Cause like I didn't leave the like Obama's awesome feeling and then just be like, oh, it all fucking sucks. It was like, oh, there's this other thing. There's this like people who actually get it and are doing work and are actually the people that all these other people are taking credit for. Like there is something really beautiful to believe in, you know, and it's not a Democratic mm-hmm. candidate, you know.
Probably no one person, no matter what party.
No one
right?
person.
You know? Yeah.
For sure. No one person. Yeah. In all caps. And then let's see. Oh, and then my entire hometown burned down. And that broke me in a true sense of the word. So I'm from Paradise, California. There was a massive fire in 2018 caused by faulty equipment by the power company who has the monopoly on electricity there. And it just shattered so much of what I know, like I could tangibly know, and just like pulled the rug out from under my feet and most people that I know's feet, you know, and so many people died. And it just rocked my foundation in a real way. And like, you guys were yep. with me that day when it happened. It was like, I mean,
which is unusual. We're not always all together. So that was like, yeah, it was like a, it wasn't just, oh, we were all hanging out at the, you know, whatever bar. We were in an intense space anyway.
Yeah. We, were like having a strategy meeting for Move to Amend. And so we were all in the same space. And then I thought I was saying goodbye to my mom as she was like running from the fire, and my dad was missing and my grandparents were missing, and a lot of them lost their homes and workplaces and schools and everything. And you know, maybe we can talk sometime more in depth about like the corporate greed and climate change portion of it all, because there's that, and it was shaking in a lot of ways, but also to see how people could live through something so clearly a result of corporate greed and climate change and still not believe yeah. in climate change, you know, this.
Yeah.
So it was just like, oh, even, and that lesson came again last year, even when we go through what feels like rock bottom, like this has to help people understand. Like, we still need people to explain it because it's not just fucking clear. And, you know, people will.
Well, and you had that perspective.
Make their own sense of it.
Because you already, yeah, you had a lot to put together. And if you don't have access to that backstory and or connections or whatever, and then you're hearing a different message loud, we're really good at believing what we want to believe.
Well, and also what has been bajillions of dollars sunk into a finely crafted narrative by the powers that be. I mean, really.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, but we also want to believe that, because it's one of the things that I was struck by as I went through my stuff is like alienation versus community and like in and out. And when you feel like, you know, you're part of the whole versus when you feel like you're like on your own, and how, you know, it's like, I think that's really hard for us. We are such communitarian mammals. So that's why the bajillion dollars work so mm-hmm. well, you know, because it's like, okay, yeah, this is what everybody else is doing. And the belonging is like a powerful influence that helps complement that billions of dollars that comes from us.
Right. Totally.
All right, well, I can go next. And if I'm talking about my trajectory, like, as I was the psychic break concept felt like a good starting point for me, except I would say that happened, like, most saliently, you know, this is a later in life radicalization story. It's not that I didn't have things radicalizing me, but it really took a lot for me to go back and put everything in context, which then further radicalized me when things in my life started to make sense and my life story made sense to me suddenly. So I was, you know, I would say was in my 30s and in the aughts, which my 30s align exactly with each decade. So from 2010 to now, I think I've gone through the most radicalization, and that had to do because I just went through a lot of trauma growing up, just a lot of it. And I was very self-absorbed and lived hand to mouth and just worked service jobs and didn't have, you know, I didn't spend a lot of time thinking about things outside of myself, to be honest. And then when I healed from some of that, like in my late 20s and went to school in my 30s for social work, because I suddenly like kind of felt like I wanted to make a difference in the world. And so at the same time, I'm like finally like able to set a long-term goal and have the energy to do it. I started to like understand things like capitalism and systemic racism and patriarchy and all of these things that, I mean, it wasn't like I had no idea about any of them, but I didn't really, nothing, these things didn't start to crystallize or connect with each other for me until, you know, I'm in school, and also things like Ferguson are happening and Obama, you know, it was like I was somebody who in 2008 was extremely excited about Barack Obama. And by 2012, after like discovering Cornel West, you know, and Tavis Smiley and hearing people critique Obama from the left was very, very, very mind blowing to me and, you know, made me not vote for him in 2012. So those things were all going on. But, you know, it was like class consciousness, I think, was like the synthesizing factor for me, because I think there was like a strain of me going to social work school. I had finally like kind of become a more whole person who was able to like kind of act normal. Nobody really knew my past. I could really kind of fake it. And I think I kind of had more of like a liberal, maybe borderline white savior, you know, mentality going into this work. And then it was like realizing, wait a second, you know, were a kid who, you know, moved 13 times because of poverty reasons. You were somebody who was in and out of jail throughout your 20s and was like caught in the system. You were raped by your landlord. You have a chronic fatal and deadly disease that can't be. And so like, it was like me kind of realizing my own place and not thinking like, oh, I need to go like, you know, support these other movements, which I, you know, obviously I do, and I know I'm still white and all of that, but it actually made me feel a part of something bigger when I was able to like admit that I had a fucked up life and it was because of, you know, class and gender, and that these are like things that I can relate to other people on, even if I didn't have your experience. I did go in and out of jail, but looking back, my experience was very different than the majority of people that I was circling through the system with. Like, I could go in front of the judge and cry crocodile tears and get a slap on the wrist. Even though I've been in and out of jail and spent more time than the average white girl, I still was treated very differently than, you know, most of the people I was in there with. And I, you know, was able to look back and understand that my mother was murdered, that she didn't just die randomly at age 40 when I was 20 from OxyContin, but that, you know, she was actively murdered. So yeah, I really like my story, even though it's embarrassing that, you know, like I really was kind of a self-absorbed, ignorant dumbass for the most part, you know, up until I was in my early 30s. I grew up in the 90s as an adolescent. That was a pretty
so the whole country was self-absorbed.
Exactly. So like, I mean, I think like on college campuses and stuff, there were people that were like learning more, but I didn't have that track, right? I didn't go to college. So I just wasn't exposed to any of this stuff. So there's a couple of little things that stick out for me in high school that in early adolescence that planted those seeds. And it was Ani DeFranco's music.
She's on my list too.
It was very weird, even though I didn't have anywhere to put it or connect it to anything else. I did discover it, and I couldn't get enough of it. And and then reading Letter from Birmingham Jail when I was 17, even though it sounds like I just had this rough working class background, which I, you know, did in a lot of ways, but I did test gifted in second grade. So I ended up leaving the gifted program. But it's weird because when you're, most people in gifted come from like more affluent backgrounds. So I was, my family was not like their families, you know, so I always felt very odd. But at the same time, like I knew that I liked some of the ways I was being challenged and that I was supposed to be there and all of that. So anyway, in 11th grade, after like not being in gifted for a long time, we had just gone to a new school and I was like, let me just take a gifted English class. I haven't done this in a while. And in that class, we read Ralph Waldo Emerson. We read Thoreau and we read Letter from Birmingham Jail. And that just, you know, I, again, didn't have anywhere to put that. I didn't have a next step, you know, to go to. But I remember reading it over and over again and just thinking, I can't believe these ideas that I'm reading. And, you know, but I just didn't know what to do with this stuff. And then when I was like 20 and I was working in this warehouse for like videotapes or something, we all smoked cigarettes and like, but got paid $8 an hour, you know, and this guy like hands me a Chomsky book and it was about non-consensual crimes. And I weirdly just like read that whole book, but never read any more Chomsky after that. It's probably like a very obscure, it was just about consensual crimes. Like when we talk about Chomsky, like, I don't, like, this book would be like number 50 on the list of like must reads, but it did still like impact me. But then I just didn't do anything with that. And then the Iraq War, for sure, was like when I started to realize our government is full of shit and lying to us constantly. And then Obama. And yeah, it wasn't really until, you know, I came to Move to Amend that I was able to kind of pull all these things together that I had kind of picked up along the way. And, you know, as I've been on this trajectory with Move to Amend and doing this work, like internally, I'm just synthesizing at a higher rate than I ever have in my whole life. And I think that, you know, yeah, and it's radicalized me. And there's one more thing I want to say, that it was a tweet that I read and I'm going to attribute it to, but it is something I want to say when we talk about radicalization and why we are radicals. So it's Kelly Albrecht, who is like, you know, a nominally big account, very attractive woman, leftist on Twitter, who I like. She said, recently one of my friends said that their radical politics are often misunderstood as harsh and unnecessarily critical, but that their political views and behaviors come from the softest part of them. They just want everyone to be okay. And I felt that. And I don't know if that like really fits into exactly what we're saying, but you know, I'm not radical because I'm, you know, there's a lot of like anger and all of that. But once I learned that like we can have a different world and people don't have to have these experiences, that is what has made me like a hard-edged radical, and I and uncompromising, because we shouldn't compromise. Once we, you know, see things, once our eyes are open to that, there isn't any going back, right? Like, that's the whole thing about radicalization. It just gives you these lenses and there's just no going back from it.
I wish I didn't feel like chagrined about Ani, because she really, I mean, she turned into kind of a joke, but like, she was,
I think she was important.
Very, very important.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, her anti-corporate also trailblazing was enormous. You know, like now Taylor Swift is like, oh, she's blah, blah, blah. And it's like, none of that stuff would have been possible if Ani DiFranco hadn't started her own record label.
No,
yeah. In terms of just the idea that musicians should own their art, that they are artists, that they are legit, and you can say fuck you to record companies. I mean... And, of course, the bisexuality, but both of those two things, you know? I mean, it's like, it's too bad that she kind of, like, became a dumb liberal, so she can't get her credit for it.
But you're totally right. I mean, you know, and she was, I think the fact that, like, I was not part of any, you know, community of anybody like that, and I still stumbled across her, and it was accessible, so I'm sure there were other people in my situation that was their first, like, window into that kind of thought, you know? And because she was so explicit, like there were a lot of radical, you know, musicians, but she was poetic and beautiful, but there was also a very straightforward, easy to understand clarity to what she was saying that you didn't have to like think about too hard like you did with some other kinds of.
Well, and she was also so honest, mm-hmm. like it wasn't about. You know, I mean, even the way the lesbian community shat all over her when she came out as bi, you know, because it was like she was really important being like, I am who I am. That's it. And I'm trying to make a living, but I'm not going to compromise who I am for the sake of making a living. Mm-hmm. There's just not that many models of people like that.
And definitely not then. And
no.
We're just working through our letting go of Ani DiFranco.
Remembering the pioneer that Ani DiFranco was.
I get it. I mean, you know, I'm not trying to compare him to Ani DiFranco, but the musician that radicalized me sold out so hard. And it's just like, how do I appreciate
Michael Franti?
Early
yeah.
How do I appreciate Spearhead and Michael? Because that was just like, I remember.
How can you have a song about how I won't sell out?
Exactly. He said, fuck the Constitution. And I was like, I didn't know we could say that.
I know.
You know, like I long I've never heard anyone talk that. Like that. A long time ago. And it just blew my mind. And then he's on some fucking Sprite commercial.
Motherfucker.
Playing Xbox. Like, I'm just like, okay, no. It's hard when they.
Yeah.
Well, Ani DiFranco didn't sell out, but she also is like, she stopped evolving in a way that doesn't make any
After
sense.
After the album Evolve, she kind of stopped evolving.
She's like, check.
She's yeah, always been very prolific, like, but I have absolutely zero interest. But I did get drunk the other night and I listened to some of her old stuff that I really liked and I had a good time.
Good stuff. I'm glad. I am glad. I remember when I showed her to Jessica and she was not impressed and I was so just like, oh!
You would think that I would really love like that type of thing, right? The Ani DiFranco, like, what's her fucking name? Alanis Morissette.
Oh, yeah, no.
Just to be clear, they're not the same. I'm not saying they were
the same.
I refuse to.
Totally I'm talking about in terms of like.
The vibe. I hear what you're saying.
The vibe. It's just the whininess I can only take for about 2 minutes. I'm sorry. I respect it. I really respect it. You know, I mean, like, I'm a gay lady. Like, I respect it, but
it's different. Ani DiFranco now is not the same thing as Ani DiFranco when there was only Ani DiFranco doing it. You know, Alanis Morissette fucking wrote on Ani DiFranco's coattails 100%. That's part of why, like, that's not a fair, but
I'm not saying it's just or right, but. It's just my ears don't like it.
My very first long distance internet boyfriend was from when I was 17, and it was from this chat room called Guest Song by Lyrics. And there was a guy who was a regular like me. He knew my Ani DiFranco. He knew my Outkast. He knew my Grateful Dead. He knew it all. He had the perfect, you know.
He was the package.
He was also on house arrest, so he was always around, and I could talk to him whenever I wanted. And then he did end up moving down. We did the whole thing. I've been doing this since I was 17.
You've been doing what? Specifically finding any just
no, falling in love with people on the internet for really fucking stupid reasons.
That happens.
So I had a weird coming to.
Wait,
say your
name.
Oh my God, it's Millie.
Say it as part of your.
Millie. 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 I can tell I'm
the fuck happened to you? All right, well, here it comes. So, well, I mean, I had a experience of young years with a very, you know, liberal surrounding influences, which, you know, can be handicapping because, A, there's such a superiority around, like, knowing all the shit. And so, you know, and then my mother, you know, we were, you could say bohemian, like there was a lot of very unusual, and now I'm very grateful for it. But like when you're in a public school and you're little, you want like everything to be very plain and normal and basic, shall we use a current word. So I, you know, I was like very much wanted like drywall. Like we lived in an adobe house. Like we had some oddball experiences. And, you know, I very much wanted everything but, you know, so I had the liberal single Jewish mother from LA in this like rural town in Cottonwood who is, you know, very fabulously smart and creative and flamboyant and like what people would describe as a character, which as a young child is again not something you necessarily want to hear about.
Can I just be a basic bitch?
I just want to be a basic bitch, damn it. Don't make me go places. No, he was seriously like, these are your like Cottonwood friends. You know, like this is not, you know what I mean? Like trying to, and that's like, again, like this liberal, like middle class, like very much attitude, you know, that like, so anyway, and then I was like around a very, you know, there was like Christians, there was like born again Christian churches on every fucking corner. And we would, it was like the, what did we have in our town? We had churches and Mexican food restaurants, which was like a pretty good fucking reflection of, you know, the demographic. And so I, anyway, very much pushed back. I wanted like this very clean, crisp, white American fucked up experience, this nuclear family, wanted it all. Became a teenager, of course, pushed back, you know, and so we had whatever our teenage mishaps do with mothers and teenage girls that I went into, had a blip in foster care. Of course, landed myself into the family that I, my dream Christian nuclear, two girls, a pop, a ma, and fundamentalist Christian, you know, like very, did everything together, like, and I got that. And oh fuck, I really didn't want it after a few months, you know what I mean? Like, oh God, what did I do? And I'm like, I kind of want to see my mom again. But like, as soon as I said that, they were like, what the fuck? You're the Jew girl we were saving. Like, this was on our bucket list. Like, this is not working for us. Get the fuck out. And then they dropped me off at foster care on a Friday afternoon, which is like, but anyway, in that process of being like, why don't I want this lifestyle? You know, why isn't this good? I did have a non-religious godmother figure who was, you know, with me, a big, huge influence in my younger years through 18 when she died. And she had more lived experience. I mean, she taught sex ed in inner cities in San Francisco. That was like her career. So like she was down, like she understood about like systematic like problems. And I think like, even though like looking back, like maybe I didn't understand conversations then, but like make a lot more sense. But anyway, one particular conversation, I'm riding with my foster sister in the car, and this is probably 2004. So we're like deep in the Iraq war. And my godmom Lily says like very frankly, like, so what do you think about the war, Katie? You know? And she was like, well, I support it because my dad supports it. And we support Bush. And it was just like, oh shit. Like what? That just like happened. Like she simplified it all down to like what the fuck was happening right there. And she might have even said pastor. You know what I mean? Like it was a very like Papa Jesus God believes in the war because Bush says it all. And like it was a very scary moment of like, what did you think you wanted? What the hell did you ever come up with this concept? Why did you have to like resist your mom so much? But so, you know, I think that was like my first, if we're gonna say like break
What were you calling it? Something way more eloquent.
Psychic break. But, oh, that's amazing that your godmother was so deft that she was like, here, Millie, I'll show you.
No, but, like, that must have been it, yeah. Right? And I was, like, sitting there, like, sphincter tightened, like, why are you doing this to me right now? You know what I'm saying? Like, not thinking of all the, you know, civilians dying of, you know, fraud, but, like, ugh. So, yeah, no, very, very helpful. You know, and I guess looking back, too, like, the knowledge that sexual education is empowerment, and that is radical as hell. And being exposed to that very young, I was so fortunate, because that was not, you know, obviously, as it sounds, like the influence of this town, like, mm-hmm. And there was so much shame around that. And in my freshman high school PE class, there were 4 pregnant girls. So, like, whoa.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, somebody just needed to have a conversation and give you a rubber, mm-hmm. man. Like, so I yeah. think that that was, you know, really gave me, I think, a different thing there. So along these lines, I didn't, you know, high school wasn't really my bag. I did a few of them, couldn't do it, got my GED. But like at the process of like moving to junior college, because I was like into school, but I was just like too into school for like high school. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I was like, I can't, like socially, I couldn't thrive. The anxiety and like depression and like everything teenage girls go through and it's not talked about, like, was too much for me, you know? So then I'm like trying to act all independent at, you know, junior college in Cottonwood, Arizona. I'm in the Bank of America, and like one of my like part-time jobs, I always rode horses, and that was like one thing my grandma did for us, or not the one thing, like, okay, my mom was a single mom, but supported by my grandmother, who had money and made sure we were safe. It was not like we ever thought that we were not going to have food. Like, we lived very poorly, but there wasn't that fear. You know what I mean? We, you know, might have been a one-bedroom adobe in, like, this very poor town, but it was still, I'd never had the fear of being hungry, which is, I think, a basic level. You know what I mean? That's a huge security blanket and privilege. So I, you know, and I did, my grandmother always, starting when she got sick, I don't know, when I was like 10, she started paying for my horseback riding lessons. And then I got really into it. And then I was like at the barn, like bucking stalls to be there all the time and like all this shit. During that time, I started like, we took care of horses, or we took care of like houses when people would go away. One of the houses we took care of was this very prominent doctor in town. Doctor, where's the like chicken noise? We need to block out the name. But anyway, this fucker with the big estate, you know, and the horses were taken care of and the pool and all this shit. He's in line at the bank bitching about, and this is, I guess, this is Obama must have been in, and we're talking about Obamacare, like, you know, all of that socialist scare that was, right? And he's standing in line and he's bitching about it, you know? And I'm like, you live in this town, like your whole client base is people on access, on government healthcare. Like, what are you talking about? Like, even before that went through. And that was like my first like public outburst.
Oh, you because, said something? I couldn't stand.
Like, I had to call him back out, you know? And I'm like, you know, I'm like, what, like 17 something, like in the line at the bank and like bitching out this really rich guy for fucking, you know, trashing this one benefit that we had in Arizona, which was some sort of borderline healthcare at that point, to think that it would be expanded at all, which, you know, it barely did. But so that was, I think, thinking in terms of like how broken bigger systems are. That was a big, big moment. He was benefiting and getting rich and off of that, but still having the nerve to say that people didn't deserve that health care. Like, it was so weird and confusing. But certainly I think lit a fire that I could like actually not be quiet, which it wasn't like it was effective or anything, but I thought that, like, you know, I don't know, it was some like moment of, okay, like fucking say some shit. And right around
that's badass.
Yeah, that's super badass.
I mean, it might have been really stupid, but like, it was what it happened. And then, okay, never sat that house again. But, I mean, the same, okay, around the same time as that, Darfur was going on. Like, it just really kicked up in my mind as, like, very present.
and like figuring out what like all the dynamics and that and how crazy like so many people were benefiting from this ongoing crisis, and like it was so clear and we were seeing the numbers rise like every day of the death, and nobody fucking cared. Like nobody fucking cared. And then this was, I think, one of my last high schools, but like I like was feeling like all righteous and shit, and like trying to organize a group of students to, like go and march in Prescott to talk about Dorfer. But like it didn't fucking matter. And it like really didn't matter. And then a couple years later, 1070 passed in Arizona, which was one of the most outrageous immigration laws ever. And that basically, you know, said that you're going to be charged if you weren't carrying documentation on you at all times, giving, you know, law enforcement the ability based on skin color to stop people and demand documentation. And I had done a little bit of volunteering on the border with a group, No Mas Muertes. So like I had like a little understanding at least about like the death toll and like putting water bottles out and like seeing like we have like this American dream crap that we spew. And then like, as Kamala Harris has said so recently, like, you know, don't come is like what we really, really mean. And these people, hundreds of people dying in the desert every year. So then this law passed and I ended up getting pulled over on a traffic thing, going too fast or whatever. And I didn't have my license. And they pulled me in and they wouldn't let me leave until I got somebody from my work to come and bring me my license. So it was hours and hours in the police department or whatever, you know what I mean? It wasn't the police, it was like the immigration, whatever, it's the same, you know. But like the lack of rights. And I luckily got a phone call. I could speak English. I got my phone call. I called somebody, they came. It took a few hours, but like to imagine in my brain, like if I was a citizen who spoke Spanish as my first language, like, and I didn't have my ID, I could have really been fucked up, you know? So fast, and the way they treat you and the way they look at you, and like, and then looking more into the bill, of course, and seeing the money pouring in from these private prisons and just seeing everything was so much bigger, bigger, bigger. So I did end up leaving Arizona. I was like, fuck this at that point. And that was like, oh, I'm going on my like find myself road trip up the coast. Landed in the Redwoods in Humboldt County and just was like, oh, fucking everything I haven't had, right? Like big trees and ocean and, you know, really liberal people, which was not like the mainstream, of course, that I had ever been around. And that was very like shiny, you know? I was like, oh, all these open-minded people. I'm gonna like unwrap that like as I go, but like it would seem very glamorous, right? So then that's where I dropped myself. And ended up going to school more and took an environmental ethics class. And at the same time, I had lost a pregnancy. And that really scared the shit out of me in terms of like, I didn't know anything about kids. And I was like, I have to learn about kids. Like, even though I lost it, I was like, just in case, if I'm ever near one, like I need to know more. So then I was like, okay, so early childhood development and environmental studies. And then like, as I was digging into this, like, they were so disconnected, you know, like kids aren't outside. They have these like specification playground sets that they go on and they never like dig in the dirt or look at a worm or like, you know, watch the way water flows or like any like natural experience. And, you know, environmental studies are definitely like looking at like adult behavior and how it's fucking shit up. And it was like, well, what happened like before then? Like, why don't we just put the babies in the mud now, you know? So that like very much started my mind of like, we are so fucking alienated from this planet. And that starts so immediate. And it like, and a nice thing about being so rural growing up is that like, I did get that unsupervised nature time outside. Like I did get to go into undeveloped desert and explore and watch animals and like everything like that. And it made it such an integral piece of like my heart and soul that like, it was like, well, nobody can get that unless they did it. You know, like you, how do you read that in a book? So that really came like fundamental into why I wanted to do work like on environmental stuff. But then the environmental justice experience can sometimes be very shallow and whitewashed. And that was very weird. and sort of witnessing that was very weird. And so much like overlap of like cultural appropriation and all these white dreads and like all of this, like, so I was like having difficulty in that place. And also seeing like all these different projects happening by these big companies. And that was, you know, Occupy started, and it was like, we started thinking about, well, what bigger is perpetuating this, you know? Like, this isn't just like people, individuals making poor choices. You know, this is like, this is so, 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 so much bigger, which brought me, that was what brought me into Move to Amend at that point, a little leaflet. And a really, really rainy action, you know? So I think that it took a lot of melding of sort of my drifting focus to really get that, like, corporations rule this country on so many levels, and that we are given solutions to that. That's just like hamster wheels to make us feel better. And, you know, people patting themselves up, you know, on the back. And so I guess that's like, how I'm here is because I am so tired of trying to work within these systems and please a generation before me that I feel like I owe. And I really fucking don't. And that's been like a strange, like, you know, recent thing of like, people have expectations of like, this is how you act. This is how you thrive. This is how you marry. This is how you love. This is how you express your gender. But it's like, no, your expectations are so crap. Like, I can totally create our own that's actually going to lead to, like, a different place, a different dynamic, you know? So I think that brings us to agitated. I, that was a little
nice.
Smooshy mooshy.
Millie, you are smooshy mooshy. We all are. I know you.
I know you don't like it.
Smoosh magoosh.
Okay, well, this is Caitlin, and thanks for sharing all the stuff that you guys have shared. And I kind of feel like I'm lucky because I get to go last. So you reminded me of things. But okay, so we all have such different backgrounds, and I love it. Even though, like you said, Shelley, at the beginning, we're, you know, in a very similar place. So I grew up in a number of different places. I mostly am from Santa Fe, New Mexico. But my family lived in Europe for 2 years, in Switzerland for 1 year, in Barcelona for a year. And then we lived in Madison, Wisconsin for 5 years when my mom was getting her graduate degree. And then we moved back to Santa Fe, which I went to for high school. And the reason why, so my family, they are artists, I guess, would be like the best description. My mom's a violinist. My dad is a Jungian psychologist. And so some of what you were describing, Millie, I could relate to. I think the thing that is different about my experience than all of yours is that I was taught that the United States was bullshit from the very beginning. And I don't remember a time where that wasn't something that I knew. Obviously, my understanding of that has deepened, you know, a lot. But I can, like, look back at, like, moments of where that was, like, reaffirmed instead of having to, like, see that for the first time. And I think that's really different than a lot of people. And at the same time, though, I'm always just so impressed and like just in awe of people who didn't get that and they came to it on your own. And I always wonder, like, well, if I hadn't been told that, you know, like, would I have been smart enough to figure it out along the way? Or, you know, I mean, I want to say yeah, but but it's just different when you're given it. And in a way that was like very, you know, it was like, it was part of the story, but we actually got real information. So like watching lots of documentaries as a kid, and thinking about how, like, it was just undisputable in terms of knowing the reality of how this country was built, much more around, like, Native Americans. My family did not have a very good race analysis around slavery and the Black American experience. Not that it wasn't, like, known and there, and but it was, like, kind of more liberal. And then, but in terms of like Native Americans, it was like, we went deep into understanding the reality. I mean, I remember watching a documentary on boarding schools and, you know, when I was like a kid and just like how, you know, it was just like, what? Like, what? What? And it's like, yeah, this is our country, you know? And so, and then also about animals. My family was very intentionally clear about like animals have as much place here as people. And so that whole idea that like human beings are you know, more special. It was just not something I had to unlearn. And I remember, but I was definitely at odds with like everyone around me. So, you know, when we lived in Madison, my friends were very like liberal people, you know, liberal, wealthy-ish people, you know, like doctors and lawyers and accountants and things like that. Those were my parents' friends. And it was weird and alienating because we were like the weirdos that was like much poorer, but at the same time, like as well educated. So like the class part was very confusing because it was like we were in that their class, but then we weren't in their class but it was mostly through choices that my parents made. So I remember during the Democratic primary in 1992 when I was in eighth grade, and my father got very involved in the Jerry Brown campaign, and that was the last time that my dad was a Democrat. And there's all kinds of like, it's so funny, Jerry Brown now is like totally useless, but and the whole time I've lived in California, that's been true. But, you know, when Jerry Brown ran against Clinton, it was a different, he was talking about corruption, talking about, you know, the way that rich people are taxed versus, you know, everyone else, et cetera, et cetera. And my dad got pulled into this campaign in a very, at the time where it was like a really populist driven effort. And so it was just like, there was no campaign. So it was like my dad and this guy who owned a bookstore on State Street in Madison were like kind of like the Jerry Brown campaign in Wisconsin for a while. And they like toured all around, like just kind of on their own, like talking to farmers and rural Wisconsin people about how, you know, we can stick it to the Clintons and the elites. And there was like tons of energy. And I really didn't understand it, but I knew it was exciting. I knew that it was, you know, it was like those were the good guys. And then like all of my friends, you know, were in a totally different place and had no sense, you know, nobody was even that political. And it wasn't really, they were just like, I just felt alienated from them. And I'm really glad that we moved. I was very upset about the fact that we moved when I finished eighth grade back to Santa Fe. But I'm really glad we did, because I feel like it was really helpful to like get away from those like liberal elitists that otherwise would have been, you know, my high school experience. So, but like I was given a People's History of the United States to read when I was in eighth grade, focusing on like the Constitution section. And I remember just being like, oh my God, this is why it is the way it is, because they set it up to not work. They set it up for themselves, you know, and having conversations with my dad. I did that as like an independent study. And so I appreciate very much like, you know, we were told things, but at the same time, I was also given, you know, material to like, you know, come to my own perspective, which I think is something that we have to like be really careful of as, you know, people who are trying to teach younger generations about like what's what, you know, like Millie, rebelling against your mom experience. It's like, you know, and I'm not saying how she parented, but I think if my parents had been more like, this is how it is, and there's not room for you to decide, we're just telling you, that it's like nobody responds well to that, you know?
Well, but I do want to say, because I might have like said like she didn't do much good, but there were some like very critical moments of calling out my teacher in the first grade, mm-hmm. for making us draw pictures of Indians and pilgrims holding hands while we lived at the edge of the Yavapai Apache Rez, and half the students were Native American. You know, mm-hmm. what I mean? Like, that was a thing. That was a huge thing to be said to me. You know what I mean? So like she did that, and she did have me read, you know, People's History. And like, so there were some things, but I do think that you have, you know, a lot to say. You digest things a lot easier when you're in the conversation, and there mm-hmm. was no conversation. There was, this is the information.
Yeah. Although, you know, it's interesting, like looking back now that I've been older and sort of like thinking about my parents' relationship, and this is sort of weird to talk about because I know they listen to this podcast, and I'm like, I don't want to hurt their feelings. But like, I really appreciate how much I was treated like an adult, but there are also a lot of ways that like that did not help me, you know? And it's like a balance there is important. I just remember being like held responsible for my emotions in a way that like wasn't fair, because I was in fourth grade or whatever. And like, yeah, I was maybe being a brat, but like you shouldn't treat a kid like they're an adult. I'll just leave it at that. So, you know, pros and cons there. But on the other hand, it did make me quite ferocious and able to like participate in adult conversations and have my opinion valued, which is huge. My dad was who gave me the first Ani DiFranco album. for my birthday. He was like, I think you'll like this. He had like read about it and like Utney Reader or something had read about Ani DiFranco and was like, but what's interesting is that both my parents were extremely uncomfortable with the fact that like when I was in high school, it started to become apparent that I was bisexual. And I was confused about that for like fucking 20 years because, I mean, part of it, Shelley, you and I have talked about this. We're not the same age. I'm a little bit older than you, but just kind of like LGBTQ-ness wasn't in the 90s versus in the 2000s in terms of like what you could say. And then obviously, you know, even more, it was just like, I just remember like there was this woman who I worked with. I worked at a restaurant when I was in high school, and this woman that I worked with, and she was gay. And we were attracted to each other and started hanging out. And I brought her to volleyball, just like I would bring my other friends to volleyball, all the boys that I also was friends with in various ways. And like both my parents were just really uncomfortable with her. And I remember my mom, you know, and we did end up making out, but like, it was just so like, I was dismissing that experience. It was like, it wasn't a real experience versus when I dated boys, that was real. And I'm not saying that people younger than me didn't have that same reality, but to have my parents who I was such good friends with and who I did talk about, you know, who I was and to be a full person around them, which, you know, a lot of people can't be their full self around their parents, but I was, but not in this area. My mom later, you know, was like, you're not gay, are you? And part of it was, is there wasn't really a language, like you were either gay right. or you were straight, you know? And so, there was, and that's so much huge.
Shaming of in between.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't even an option. It was like in between is just slutty and confused. And, you know, so I kind of, I just sort of took that to be like, I guess I'm just, you know, everybody is kind of interested in sex in general. And this is me just being interested in sex and all the options of it. And so it was just like, it's so weird to be somebody who like, and I think this is like the only psychic break I've had when I think about it, of like where what I thought was true wasn't actually true, was like coming to the fact that I am bisexual and that's a real thing. And but not until like not really owning that until like well into yeah. my 30s. But then being somebody who spent so much time and energy, you know, being really conscious of who I am and what I believe and who I am in the world. And then to have this huge part of me like not even really be able to be let in until I was so old. That's embarrassing and fucking agitating as
but
well.
It's freeing again, like freeing from the expectations that, you know, prior generations had made. I mean, how dare yeah. they like put boxes in queerness?
I know
what happened and, you know, trickled on us so hard residually. Right.
yeah and, you know, bisexuality and biphobia are such a unique thing because, you know, there have been bisexual people in a strong, thriving bi community for decades, but there still exists a major, major hate from
yep. all sides.
Yeah. Some lesbians and some gay people. And I can't tell you how many times I had someone, well, you think it's a phase, but like, that's going to last. Well, I'm married to a woman and I'm still bisexual. So it's not a phase. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so you get it from straight people and you get it from gay people. And it's just a whole lot of shit. I don't think that I'm not saying you shouldn't feel embarrassed. I don't mean to police your emotions, but there's nothing to be embarrassed about there. That's as set up as anything else we talk about. That's a setup.
Oh, totally. And I do like, I'm not embarrassed now, but I was embarrassed going through that, you know? Yeah. And it was like, it was just so confusing because it was like, I'm somebody who analyzes. I mean, I have a young psychologist father, right? Like everything is pulled apart and analyzed and, you know, and just sort of like what's yeah. underneath and what's, and then to be like my whole sexuality was like wrong, you know.
No, but that was just also shocking with my mom, of like, she, you know, she's like, I did the marches, I did this, I know what mm-hmm. it is, you know, I have and, you know, and not that she doesn't have gay friends, but, you know, her dearest and truest yeah. but like still there's like, then when it was like me talking about it, it's like, no, I can't right. wait to pick your wedding
kid. It's really different,
you know.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it comes out of confusion. Like, my mom and I have had some really good conversations since, and so, you know, it's like she didn't have any words either. If I didn't have words, then why the hell would she have had words? But it still is just, it's just very upsetting, you know, to be erased in with people that you thought you could trust in that way, and then it turns out you can't. And I don't think that was the intention at all, but it's certainly what happened. And that's been really hard to talk about after, you know, because she feels guilty and bad. And, you know, they tried really hard not to do that to me in every way. And then it was like, and then there's this big one. So anyway, the other thing, too, is that so when I went to college, I finally felt like, OK, I found my political people. Like, I just bounced around with all these like liberals and and disdain coming from my family towards them because my dad had like, you know, seen what the Democratic Party was when I was a kid and was very vocal about it, you know. So I was really wanted to vote for Ralph Nader in 1998, but I wasn't old enough yet. I wasn't 18 and for that election. For example, so I went to college and I went to a really liberal school, really small school, Hampshire College in Massachusetts, and was like, finally my people. But then it was so weird because, again, like the class piece came up, which really wasn't something that was, you know, it just wasn't in the framework unless you kind of had socialist parents. I think that that was like kind of the only place where class was talked about at all. And I did not have socialist parents. And so it wasn't. I do remember though, I took this class on whiteness. I forget what the exact title was. It was my first year there. It was very cutting edge. Like, colleges were not having critical race theory classes yet to speak of. It was this really edgy young teacher. And my experience in there was so confusing because on one hand, there was a lot that I was resistant to because I was like, I'm already, you know, woke and I don't have more to learn. And I was defensive about it. But on the other hand, I've thought about it since, because in the moment I was really uncomfortable. I ended up dropping the class. I kind of hated everybody. And I remember, you know, a lot of ignorant stuff about like, I don't see race and blah, blah, blah. So that was definitely going on for me. And part of it, too, was, you know, having grown up in New Mexico, which is on one hand a multiracial place, but there are no Black people there. And, you know, the experience for Black Americans is totally different than it is for Hispanic, not even really Latino, because in New Mexico, you know, it's a different thing there, too, around that. And so anyway, but I, you know, I was like, I already know all this stuff. Super defensive. But on the other hand, I think a lot of what turned me off also was the fact that I was in this school with like all these rich people. Hampshire cost $33,000 a year when I went, which was, you know, now it's like nothing, but that was a lot in 1998. And I was on almost full financial aid because they wanted to have people from every state. Not that many people from New Mexico apply to go to college at Hampshire College. But that's a young school. It was founded in 1971, and so they have no endowment. And so half of the people have to pay full tuition. I don't know what the formula is now, but that's what it was there. And of the people who get financial aid, half of them have to take at least 50% or pay at least 50% or more. So it's just a lot of New England wealthy kids who could not get into Ivy League schools. And so they went to Hampshire College. And so just the weird like waspiness of the conversation and the class stripping of class elitism, but in a liberal way was so alienating to me. And it was so disappointing about like, I'm finally in college where people can be political. I mean, all my life I wished that I'd grown up in the 60s because then I could actually like do something. And you can't do anything in the 90s. You know, nobody's interested in doing anything. So the 60s was the only time. Well, the music you were listening to, I'm sure was, you know, a part of what made that feel real to you. And so, yeah, so it was just so weird to be with all these rich people, but liberals, and then no place to explain that or talk about that. It wasn't until my third year where I was like, wait a minute, and I learned this formula of everything, and I was like, but all of my friends are on, like, almost all financial aid, you know, and there's, like, barely any of us. Like, huh, maybe we found each other in the sea of liberal white rich people. So anyways, a couple other things that I just wanted to talk about. 9/11 was so weird for me because I was in a pear orchard in rural, like actually near here, Sacramento. We were in Placerville. And we had just started this 5-day retreat of activists who were working against corporate personhood. I had come to Northern California to work with Democracy Unlimited not knowing at all what I was getting into or even what that was because it was such a vague thing. But so I had a totally different experience than like everyone because we didn't have TV. All we had is Democracy Now for information. I mean, just thinking about like that flag waving, like crazy time and being in this weird, isolated, leftist, radical enclave. It's like on one hand, that experience changed my life, but it wasn't really 9/11. It was choosing to drop out of school at that point, college, and then stay in Humboldt and help build up Democracy Unlimited. And the one other thing that I just wanted to talk about, you know, happened much more recently, but 2 summers ago, I was arrested at the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. with other folks from Extinction Rebellion. And we super glued ourselves to the doors and the tunnels that lead from the congressional administrative offices to the Capitol. And we were trying to raise attention and get them to move the resolution to act on climate change forward. It was a weird action for me in that I didn't help organize it at all. I was like a pinch hitter at the last second. I was just friends with somebody who was part of it, and they had somebody back out, and they needed enough people to glue our hands to the doors so that nobody could get through. And so they needed somebody else to be able to like make the action work. So he literally asked me like the day before, and I didn't even know what we were agreeing to when I said, sure. I hadn't actually ever been arrested for civil disobedience before. I'd like supported other actions. Oh, and one thing I had meant to mention is that in 2001, In 1999 was, you know, the WTO protests in Seattle. And I was not there, but I was paying attention and was like on the computer on indie media, like following what was happening, and was so upset that it was like on the West Coast and we couldn't go. And so then in April, the following year, it was my last semester at Hampshire before I left. There was a IMF World Bank protest at the in DC, and that was kind of going to be like our Seattle. But protesting in DC is super different than Seattle, and the police in DC know what they're doing, and the Seattle police at that time did not. So anyway, it ended up like we were not able to shut down the IMF World Bank meetings because they know how to make sure that you don't shut down any meetings. But, and I will skip a lot of it, but that was that was what caused me to take a semester off from school and go out to California, is because it was like, oh my gosh, this movement, I mean, that was the globalization movement coalescing in the United States. And it was so exciting and so powerful. And it felt like, you know, there's actually, I mean, for whatever reason, the Iraq war, my response to that was just like cynicalness, because my, you know, parents were just like, yeah, this is bullshit. It's all bullshit. It's always been, you know, but there was no play. It was like, or so we did go to, you know, a protest of whatever, however many people. It was probably like 100 or so. I mean, that's my memory of it in Madison. But it was like, that's not powerful. That's not going to stop anything. That doesn't change anything. And no one's even here to try and stop anything. We're just here to sort of be like, no. You know, it was like, that was not something that I was excited to be part of. It just felt depressing. But here, all of a sudden, it was like, wow, there were these, I don't know if you guys remember, but like there was, you know, Newsweek had a special on anarchists, and it was like all about, you know, describing consensus and what their hand signals mean and blah blah blah, because there were, you know, a bunch of anarchists in Eugene were a huge part of the Black bloc, you know, holding it down in terms of what happened in Seattle. That was not all that happened, but it was such so funny to sort of like be on the edge of that but not in it, and then jump into it. And so, you know, I was definitely like, okay, well, now that there's a movement, I fuck college. I'm going to go find this movement and go be part of it. So anyway, but I had never had an opportunity to get arrested myself. And so back to 2 years ago and Congress, and oh my God, you guys, super glue is so scary. Like, you know,
hand got fucked up.
My hand was okay. Right? It was okay. Well, on top of the whole thing, I ended up being assaulted by a congressperson, and he ripped my hand off of the glass, and no one thought that was going to happen. We thought maybe the police were good. We did think that the police might pull us off, you know, and just the fact that, like, I had no idea, and then I get there, and they're like, wait, do you know what we're doing? And I already had raised my hand and said, like, yeah, you know, because I was just like, this is what you do if you have an opportunity, you know, and I was like, excited, I'll finally have my chance. But, you know, my experience with people getting arrested was, you know, the action is relatively safe, you know, and like, then maybe what happens with the police afterwards. I mean, what happened in 2000 was that, you know, the arresting, I wasn't one of the people, I did jail support, but the people who did get arrested, it was all orchestrated with the police and it was all, you know, very tame. They did get the crap beat out of them in the buses afterwards and, you know, a lot of abuse and assault and, you know, it was scary. But the actual act of getting arrested normally, you know, in civil disobedience, in my experience, was always something that was like, you could decide whether or not you were going to get arrested. And, you know, if you did, it would be, you know, fairly tame, and especially in the Capitol. But the super glue put this charge on it that was fucking scary. But I was like, okay, that's okay. I'm going to do this. And it ended up just being incredibly powerful and exciting. And I just wanted, one of the things that I wanted to say about that is that if you have an opportunity to get arrested and do civil disobedience, you should. And we all should be finding ways that our actions can be that, because when they are able to manage what our purpose is, we are not acting as powerfully as we can. And obviously in the last few years, there's been, you know, tons of uprising within, you know, Black Lives Matter and pipelines. And, you know, there's been a lot that has happened in that. So there will be more opportunities and we just need more people to do it. And for me, it was hugely liberating to, I said this in the last episode, but to be able to have a day where it's like, I'm actually carrying out my values and my actions today. We don't do that very often. It's hard to find places to do that. That's part of, I think, the source of, you know, a lot of our agitation and why it's like, how do we act powerfully? How do we actually act in a way that is on par with the devastation and the harm and the horror that is being done to us and other people and the planet in a way that actually, you know, gets it to them, or at least surprises them, or, you know, puts us a little bit on the offense. We're always on the defense. How do we get on the offense? You can't win unless you can be on the offense somehow. And that's like the nut we have to crack. And so trying to find ways. And, you know, did it make any difference in terms of Congress? No. But I'll say that it was also, you know, doing the work. I was in DC because I were, you know, working with Move to Amend, and I was there to lobby Congress members. And it felt like the most productive thing I did that summer was that one day versus everything I was trying to do when I went into their office politely and had bullshit conversations with their staff. Mm-hmm. And then they told me, you know, week after week after week, yeah, we'll think about it. We'll think about it. And, you know, I am proud of that. I'm proud of the super glue part of it. Was really scary. And I thought about, like, bailing a couple times. And I'm proud that I didn't. And I look forward to the time when we can super glue ourselves to something else. I think that's everything I want to say.
Yeah, that was pretty badass. I just wanted to pull out a thread that I heard all of us talk about, which was our coming to our own understanding of our own class. Mm-hmm. Situation. I feel like that's interesting. I think similar to Millie, it's like my immediate family didn't have money, but we had people in our family who had enough money that we never thought we were gonna not have food, you know, and a lot of other privileges as well. It was like there was a strong working class identity in my family that, you know, we didn't have fancy things, and people who had fancy things had debt, and you don't want debt, and everyone's lying. They don't actually, it's all bullshit. You know what I mean? We don't live beyond our means, and that's the right thing to do. But then that would be embarrassing because I would have friends who's like, my parents drove like a big ass rickety pickup truck. And I thought that was embarrassing sometimes, you know, when we'd pull up to things, and like, there were things that my parents were not embarrassed about and were just like, other people are bullshit. But like growing up and finding myself, I was sort of like, oh no, like that's,
oh my God. For us, it was thrift stores. I would lie to my friends. I remember I had this cool pair of jeans that I had gotten at a thrift store with my mom. And the thrift store was on the way between our house and school. And it was like on our walk. So like, I was just always, you know, it was like our neighborhood. So I was like, oh my God, people are going to see me in here. And I remember my friends were like, where'd you get your cool pants? And I was like, my mom found them in a box in the garage, which was like, there wasn't even a box of clothes in the garage. I just had to think fast. I'm like, how can I explain these clearly not new pants that I have?
Understanding what class you're part of is a very confusing thing sometimes.
All right. Thank you for tuning in. You can sign up for our email list so you can get a notification whenever a new episode drops. Sign up to get notified at agitatedpodcast.com. And we want to hear what's agitating you. So let us know at agitatedpodcast.com. Click the menu item titled What's Agitating You. You can write in or record a message that we may play in the future on an episode. You can also leave us your feedback under the Contact Us section of the website.
Don't forget, we've got stickers. If you'd like one, drop us a line with your address through any of our social media channels or the website. And speaking of social media, we'd love to connect with you there. You can find us at Agitated Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
Please don't forget to subscribe and rate us 5 stars on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you tune into podcasts. And if you would, leave a positive review on iTunes. It really helps the algorithm bump our podcast and new people find us on our show.
And please share us with your friends. Podcasts like ours grow through word of mouth. So thank you for your support. And a big thanks to Jason and Radical Guide for helping us produce this show and Alfonso for helping us with promotion. See you next time. The pain will